views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. I am your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to sit down and listen to these authentic conversations. Today is no different. I have the pleasure, the honor, and the privilege to interview the CEO of Kesha Financial, Mr. James Poor. Kesha Financial is a $500 million financial services company, and probably one you've never heard of. But I'll let James explain what they do. James and I have a lot in common, except for he is much more evolved as a human being. You see, James, at a time in his life, never really felt like he belonged in the room until he read a Dr. Seuss book that his wife so kindly, sweetly, and gently left in his car seat. And now, he believes that Dr. Seuss could solve world hunger, cancer, and possibly world peace all at once. So let's all get our Dr. Seuss books and have a read. So stay tuned today for Mr. James Poor, CEO of Kesha Financial. Also, for those of you who know that I am super excited to be part of the C-Suite Network. It's a place you go to get all the relevant content for any C-Suite executive. Finally, as always, please leave a review on iTunes and subscribe. It helps. It helps immensely for myself, for you, for the listeners. All right, everyone. Have an awesome week. See you. So James, can you just tell my audience, 10,000 foot level, like what company you're at and what position or role that you have there?
Sure. I'm the president and chief executive officer of a financial services company called Kestra Financial. And our job is to empower the success of independent financial advisors.
Okay. So I love the marketing tagline. That was brilliantly well delivered there. I've always been
my elevator speech.
Yeah,
right?
No, it's great. It's great. I've always wondered, how can someone be president and CEO? Like, are those roles mutually inclusive or exclusive?
Well, I think it's the same job, at least for the size of organization that we have. Now, what different people run different sorts of organizations, and I have put serious thought into if I ever wanted to hire a president. And so by way of example, what would drive me to do that would be, we're out in the marketplace looking for acquisitions right now. So if I were to make several acquisitions, that would change to some fairly significant degree what I do with my day-to-day life. And so I may, at that point, bring someone in to be, quote-unquote, the president of certain components and to take on a large area of my responsibilities so that I could focus on, the next big thing for the company. So I think that's when you see it divided for a much larger company.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's consolidated at many firms our size, and we're about just short of $500 million in revenue organization. So that's how we run it.
Well, and that's not like you're small. I mean, that's not.
No, it's a good-sized company.
Yeah. So I've always – again, this is my ignorance. This is me being in academia probably way too long at this point. What's the role differentials between a president and CEO? So in my mind, a CEO is usually out glad handing, strategizing, looking at possible acquisitions, but really tries to stay away from the day-to-day stuff. And the president's more, I wouldn't say COO, but maybe more strategy side.
Yes to all of those. It really just depends on the organization who's running it. So to echo your point, yeah, I see my role predominantly as one that is focused on exponential growth. My job is to make sure that I'm working with investors. Mm-hmm. My job is to make sure that I'm empowering the people who report to me to be successful, and to make sure that we are on track to hit our financial goals. In the simplest form, those are my responsibilities. And when those become so overwhelming from a time standpoint, that is when I certainly do need to fully empower either a really strong COO or president over more day-to-day functionality. So I see the world very similar to how you described it.
So from a personality standpoint then, so do you need to have those roles from a control perspective, or is it just something that you don't feel the company's grown to that size yet to where you need to delineate the roles?
A little bit of both. Predominantly, I don't think that the company has evolved to take that next step yet. But there are some functional components in terms of corporate structure and so on that require different sort of titles for whatever reason. Often ones I don't fully understand, but my attorney says it has to be that way.
Well, and I noticed looking at, doing a little research before the call, your organization has done a series of acquisitions over the last 3 to 5 years.
Right.
And so that's predominantly your growth strategy, right? It's just through acquisition.
I wouldn't say predominantly. I think any leader needs to keep his eye on organic growth. And then we've made substantial investments in making sure that we're supporting organic growth and empowering that and helping people who we serve run better businesses. There's no better way to grow with a high degree of confidence beyond organic, because at any given time, the marketplace for acquisitions could get challenging. And so I first and foremost want to make sure that my team of executives and beyond are really focused on supporting organic growth.
Yeah, I mean, organic is the most sustainable, but like doing acquisition can be capital heavy. And I'm assuming either you're taking on debt to do it or using capital to purchase, one of the two.
Sure, we do both. We do both equity and debt financing on deals. But I will tell you this, it is a lot easier to help a valued client figure out how to grow their business 10% than it is to go find another one.
Oh, totally.
So, that's how we view it.
When I talk to students, one of the things I tell them is that it's always less expensive to keep your customer than it is to get new customers. So,
that's it.
Same premise. So how does a guy become a CEO/president? Are you originally from Austin?
No, I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
And, I don't think you take my path, but I somehow managed to wiggle it out.
Who did you pay?
Well, that's I can't get into that publicly, but, it's really funny. My son, one of my sons is about to start high school next year, so he's finishing up eighth grade, and he's a fantastic student. And getting in high school, he got all these wonderful letters of recommendation and everything from his teachers. And I remember looking at my wife saying, no one in middle school or high school would have looked at me and thought, wow, that guy's really going to sort of leave a mark or create a lot of success. And it's been an interesting journey, to say the least.
Well, let's unpack that. I mean, as we talked earlier, I mean, that is a big chunk of my podcast, is to understand your journey. So that's where you and I probably relate a lot. There's a saying that I have with a friend of mine where we always say it's the C students that manage the A students. Right. So and the reason behind that is that you learn to be more social. You learn to have typically higher emotional intelligence when it comes to dealing with people. But when you were growing up, I mean,
What was your family focus? Was it on sports? Was it on academics? Was it like just be around? Like what was it?
Yeah, you know, I looking back sort of as an adult now, I think that our family's focus when I was growing up was really just one of survival, for lack of a better way of putting it. And so, you know, there was always sort of that just sort of getting by sort of environment. And that sort of, you know, that really had an impact on me. And so there was really not a large focus on sports, although I loved sports and played them when I could. I would not say academics were a focus really at all. I was not a very strong student, and it was expected that I pass.
So were you like a lower income?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I would say, I was sort of expected to pass. I was expected to get out of high school, was sort of the expectation put on me. But, you know, if I cruised through with all C's to do so, that was perfectly acceptable.
What kind of message did that send you? Because I'll share with you a story in a second. But what kind of message did that send you?
You know, I don't know that I was intelligent enough to sort of break through and understand any messages sent to me. But, you know,
I love the honesty of that answer. Go ahead. Sorry.
But I will tell you sort of how I reacted was, you know, the message in my home very early, and I will tell you that this created very strong benefits for me as an adult, was you need to work. You need to go get a job. And so I've had a job since I was 14 years old. And I mean, where I was working for someone for a check and compensation. So I was 14, which is basically, you know, right at my freshman year in high school. And so, you know, the message was go get a job. As soon as I could in high school, I was, you know, sort of dictated by my parents, I needed to be in the work program, which meant you went to school in the mornings and then you went to a job in the afternoon. So, you know, my last 2 years of high school, I only went to school from 8 to 11 or 8 to noon.
Wow.
And then I went to a drugstore and stocked shelves and checked people out and unloaded trucks and whatever else I needed to do.
That's crazy. It's fine.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, I learned how to work.
Well, totally, right? Like, yeah. I was gonna say, you know, my mom, we have this conversation to this day, and I am always flabbergasted by it, no matter how many times we've had the conversation. But I'd always ask her, like, why didn't you push me more academically? Mm-hmm. You know, it's easy probably externally to see it. We have a PhD, like clearly you're academic, but that if you were to ask anybody who knew me, similar to you earlier, who knew me from high school or college, they would be like, what the hell? Like, how did you get that? Right. So anyhow, my mom would always say to me, always, I was like, Mom, why didn't you push me? Like, just a little bit, just push me a little bit. And she was like, I was just worried you were going to turn to drugs. And I was like, so was like, was your barometer of me so little that, and you thought I was so fragile that the minute I was pushed? So as you learn this work ethic, you clearly went to TCU because you have it plastered on a couple different places I've seen. Did you go right from high school to TCU?
No, not at all. I went to junior college for a year. I did not do well. I moved out of my parents' home right after high school and started supporting myself in a crappy little apartment that was was horrible. And I went to junior college for 2 semesters. I did not do well at all. And, you know, I was having really struggles finding a way to focus on the academics because, again, they were never a priority in my home. And my parents weren't comfortable with academics. My parents didn't go to college. So I remember when I finally figured it out and started really clipping off semesters and getting through and heading towards degree, I remember explaining to my mom one time how college worked with semester hours and so on. They weren't comfortable with it, is why it wasn't a priority in my home.
How old are you, like, when you started actually going full time?
Well, so I went for 2 semesters, worked full time, and took 2 semesters of college, didn't perform well. So I took a year and a half off. I just didn't go to school for a year and a half, and I just worked. Now, what's interesting is when I was 19 years old, I started working at a bank, and that led to me working at a financial services company. I've been in this industry since I was 20.
Holy cow.
And that's what ultimately inspired me to go get a to get an education. And that's what drove me.
What about it?
And I started realizing. Well, I worked around a lot of people in finance, a lot of people that were investing assets for high net worth clients. I was exposed to a different, really, type of person and a side of life than I had ever been in my life. And I started, I was around wealth and I was around people who were managing wealth. And I just realized one day, my job was to build a spreadsheet that tracked the commissions of financial advisors. Back then they were called stockbrokers in the 80s. And I just sort of look at the spreadsheet one day, and these guys were making like $100,000 a year, which to me was all the money in the world.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, these guys aren't all smarter than me. And I just thought, I need to get an education. If I get an education, then there's no reason that I can't be in this business and create personal wealth and great success for myself. And that's really was core to me getting it and getting back in school. So I was off for a year and a half. So then I went back to school, did another year at junior college where I did really well then. And then got into TCU and went to TCU for, 3 years and finished up.
So, I always wonder about that. So I come from a, lower middle household. I mean, both my parents worked, but my mom was a bank manager. My dad worked for a chemical company. Neither finished college. My dad was one class away. Like, who the hell doesn't finish from one class away? Like, anyhow.
That's what they always say. I never get that one either.
Yeah, I'm just like, what?
A lot of people are one class away from a degree, though.
I just find that fascinating. Anyhow, so I didn't grow up with any wealth. I still would argue now I don't have any wealth. But
no.
what I find is I think money sometimes is really uncomfortable for me. And the idea or thought of having wealth, we could define wealth in all sorts of different ways. I mean, that's an open interpretation. But for me, it's living comfortably, being able to take trips, save for college, have a retirement. I'm not talking about the 10-bedroom mansion at all, though in Texas, that wouldn't be that much.
Right.
But so how did you ever have that struggle with money, like trying to understand the value of it since you were never raised with that?
Sure. I certainly went through, my eyes, I didn't blink for years looking at these numbers quite often. And I would be fascinated by it. And what I loved about it was learning how people made money, because while I was striving to get an education and find any way I could to move myself forward, I also really started respecting and understanding that not everybody needs an undergrad or graduate degree to create success. So you would see, guys that were truckers figure out how to start a business or a product or to buy another truck and have someone else drive it, build these really wealthy businesses. And it makes you have such great respect for entrepreneurs and capitalism and opportunity. That was what always sort of got me spellbound. And then as I got more mature, you sort of, you always have to respect people's wealth and understand that that's what they have to create their future. And so that is key in, first of all, my thought process and in our industry. But after a while, it's numbers, right? You, and I don't mean that in a negative way, because I'm unbelievably dedicated to doing the right things for clients in our organization. But there's less shock because you work for solving a lot of wealthy people's sort of business. But, it's interesting.
But I would imagine initially as you started moving up the ranks, there was a sense of of euphoria and uncomfortableness at the same time as your salary starts going up and you have more disposable income. And, I can only imagine my check is this big and what the hell do I do with it? And I want to have this toy that I've never had before in my life. And that pull and push and,
Well, I will tell you one of the, yes. So that was certainly an adjustment for me. And I still view the world like a poor kid, and I really do. And that's, something that has sort of been prevalent in my life. You may throw a peanut butter jar out you know, 5 days before I would, because I'm convinced I can scrape another sandwich out of it.
Sounds like my wife.
I very much think of the, I live my life that way. I mean, I view the world that way, and it's really hard for me not to. But I'll tell you, a great day for me was when I received an annual bonus 1 year. My bride and I paid off my student loans all in one sort of, you know, I had years more of payments, and we got rid of the student loans. That was, you know, it's a really proud day where I put myself through college. It clearly was, I was blessed to have it pay dividends, and I was able to pay for it. It was, you know, a really special moment where your question is concerned.
Can I just tell you how excited I will be the day I pay off my student loans? I owe at this point mid six figures. So,
it's a lot of money, my friend.
Yeah. It depresses me sometimes. I don't think people can understand who, again, I don't hate anyone who never had college debt. Like, I couldn't have done what I'm doing without taking student loans. Like there was no wealth in my family to do it. There was no option.
Me neither.
And so, yeah. So to not do it, what was the alternative? I don't think people appreciate or understand. I don't know if appreciate is the right word, but understand that it can be a mini noose around your neck, so to speak.
Yeah, I can, but and perhaps institutions need to go several steps further in educating. But because I will tell you this, if you borrow your money, it's your responsibility to pay it back. And I view the world as simple as that.
Yeah.
And borrowing money to pay for my education was one of the best things I ever did for me. And I will tell you why. Because every semester that I started anew at Texas Christian University, I took 12 to 15 hours a semester. I worked 40 hours a week at a wealth management company. And I knew that the worst thing I could do to myself was to not finish school, not earn the degree, and still have the debt.
Oh, yeah.
So I was reminded every semester when I signed new paperwork to take on more debt and add more to that pile of the requirement that I had to succeed. There really wasn't an option that I had to find to figure out how to get everything done.
So I was listening to you there. And first of all, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. But I was listening to what you were saying. It struck me, though. It got me thinking, you've always had to kind of be the adult in the room. Meaning you've always had to work. Yeah. You've always had to be the guy. Like, I'm sure you had your fun, but I am pretty comfortable to say that, like, you didn't have the typical college experience where 40 hours a week really isn't what you do in college. It's maybe you drink 20 hours a week and then you study 20 hours a week, you know, at least that was my model, unfortunately. So,
right. It's a strong model.
Do you ever look back and kind of pine for having a little bit of different path, or are you just super grateful for the way you did it?
Well, I will tell you that when I was going through it, I was angry about it. I was often irritated that I had to do it the way I had to do it. But I will tell you this. I would not be the chief executive at a large financial services company if I did not do it that way, because I learned so much about me. I built confidence that I never had. I put myself out years out in front of my age group peers. I hit the ground running in a mad sprint when I got out of college, and that made a difference. So I don't look back and wish it were different now as an adult with a lot more emotional maturity around my, in my life, but it was hard then. Admittedly, it was hard. And I was often irritated and angry.
I was bitter
because I was taking on debt. I wasn't making a lot of money at the job that I had. I was trying to figure out how to support myself. There are people that helped me when they could. My mom was certainly always trying to find ways to help me. My car would break down. My mom didn't have two nickels drove together, but she would go get my car fixed and put it on her credit card. And she knew I was struggling. She knew I was trying. I'm glad now it wasn't different. And my concern is to my children now and making sure that they find a way to grow internally the way I did without putting them through the stress and the burdens that I had. So I'm constantly trying to figure that out.
Well, you know, I mean, one of the things that I've really, that's really struck me with doing this podcast is just the consistency of people beginning their first job between 10 and 13. The consistency of them being CEOs and executives and multimillionaires because they either had to work or yeah. chose to work. And most of them had to work. I don't think many of them was a choice. And the lessons that it taught, you know, I'm always convinced now after doing this podcast, if this podcast stopped tomorrow, it would not change what I will do with my kids when they turn 12, 13. Like, they will find a job. It doesn't have to be a 40-hour-a-week job, but it has to be something they have to go to, be on time, work hard at. And the other thing that's really interesting is, you know, the amount of people that had, and it makes sense, so, but had manual labor jobs where they had to basically get dirty and do, I mean, and so, you know, for me and probably for you, if you're trying to manufacture something similar, it's going to be the kids working. I mean, that's the only way they figure out work ethic.
Yeah.
You know,
it is. And it's especially challenging with kids this age because, you know, my kids are spend a lot of time on academics, studying, homework, et cetera. They have a lot of homework. And then they're focused on athletics, and I want them to have that experience and focus on that as well. My kids don't have time for a job.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm hoping to find ways over the summers, especially once they're in high school, to they've got to find something that they can do where they understand the concept of going, doing something in return for compensation, doing it well, seeing the taxes coming out of your check. You know, I don't want that first experience for them to be an internship at college or even after they get out of college. My kids will work. We'll find a way to make that happen.
I was also thinking earlier, were you the first one in your family to go to college?
Yes, I was definitely first one to graduate.
And did any of your siblings go to school?
Not really. I have none of them have college degrees.
Okay.
I have a sister, and then I have stepbrother and stepsister. I was the only one to go through and finish college.
Not that we need to dive too deep into that. I'm just curious in terms of like relatability at this point, you know, like when you go back and see them, or they can't be that far away from you because you're in Texas, but the relatability of lifestyle and direction, is it sometimes challenging for you to kind of get your head around it?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. It is. Without a doubt.
Yeah. That would be, because I was just thinking, how old are you? Do you mind me asking?
No, sure. I'm 46 years old.
I was gonna say, yeah, you don't sound very old, and you look great by the photos. So I mean, whatever you're doing, keep it up.
I'm 15 years old. But, yeah. No, I assume it's fairly current, but you know, I'm every bit of 46. I'm not a guy that feels 20 years older. I'm not a guy that feels 20 years younger. I love where I'm at in life.
Yeah.
It's, you know, 40s are a great, great age.
Well, it's funny. A really close friend of mine who's a priest, who married my wife and I, he said, you know, my 30s were better than my 20s, and my 40s were better than my 30s. So I'm hoping that pattern stays consistent for myself. But I was going to ask you actually. So tell me a little bit about like just your immediate family. Like, how long have you been married? How'd you meet your wife?
Sure. I met my wife at depending on who we talk to, either at a restaurant or a bar. And we'll celebrate 20 years of marriage on July 19th this year. We're very excited. Yeah, she was I was out with a few friends of mine. She was at a four top table with two girlfriends late one night on this patio, and I kept staring at her and finally got the courage to go talk to her. And, you know, it just sort of took off from there.
That's awesome. And you have two kids?
I just, at the time I did, we have three sons.
Okay.
And they're, Austin's 14, Luke is 12, Jacob is 9. They're 8, 6, and 4th grade. They're a blast. They're challenging. They're fantastic. You know, everything that parenthood should bring you.
So as you were being a parent, you know, this is another fascinating topic because it's something that I didn't have the best role models as parenting growing up. So I found them outside my family, probably more importantly. How did you form your parenting style? Did you defer to your wife a lot? Like, I defer to my wife for certain things. And
well, you know, there are certainly some areas where my wife and I will both defer to one another. And then if something sort of gets at a certain level of importance, then we sit down and we talk through how we think we should handle something. What I found about my wife is got deeper into parenting is that she has a really strong, pretty amazing intuition, especially when the kids were really small. And I learned that I really needed to trust her judgment. She was around them a heck of a lot more than I was. And B, she just, you know, I don't know if it's mother's intuition or that she is super exceptional at it. It's probably a combination of both. But, you know, I really trust her judgment, and I think she's really good with it. Now, as the boys have gotten older and they're getting into those sort of teen years, you know, I certainly know what it's like to be a teenage boy. Yeah. And so a lot of those sort of topics, you know, I think she really kind of looks to me more on certain things and vice versa. And, you know, she's, we make a great team. Yeah. She's a warrior.
Yeah.
And
she's
I'm
a mom.
Always like, you exactly, that's her job, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm very much like, I'm always a long-term picture guy, who sometimes I literally want my kids to fail at something.
Yeah.
Because I want them to hit the wall while they're in our home and under our influence and learn how to overcome those things. And so, you know, we have a particular situation that we're dealing with where all my sons perform really well in school and really blessed. And one of them is far more, he's a backloaded student. And he's going to kind of wait till the end and go jam it all through. And he's super smart, and he has really had success with that. And I keep telling him at some point it's going to catch him.
Yeah.
And then my bride gets, you know, antsy over it. And I just keep telling her, we've got to let him fail. We need him to have a quarter in school where he doesn't make honor roll because he waited too long.
Yeah. I have a friend of mine who's very, at least she was very hands-on with her son who was in, I want to say he was in eighth grade at the time, very hands-on, like sat down with him and did his homework. And I was like, you have to let him just screw up now.
Yeah.
Like,
absolutely.
She's like, it's so hard. I'm like, you don't understand. You're not going to be there at some point. So if he doesn't figure out how to sort this out himself, he's going to fail at 20, not 13. Which one is?
Yeah, you go to college with him.
Yeah, exactly. So it's so hard, you know, in that capacity. But I think the thing I keep coming back to though is like, how did you, like, I don't know, like, what resources did you pull to make choices about being a parent? Or, because, like, give me my wife as an example. She comes from this amazing family. I mean, disgustingly amazing.
Right.
Everyone loves everyone. There's no black sheep. When her siblings get together, they hug and kiss and lay on each other and reminisce. And, like, when we're at our parents' house, all the boys, her oldest brother is 43 or 42. Youngest is like mid-30s. Mm-hmm. We're out in the backyard playing like frisbee and soccer and running around the whole time, like straight up chaos, right? And everyone gets along. So there's that. And then we have my family where I don't talk to any of my siblings. I'll see my mom once every 2 years being out here. And even in Philadelphia, when I was in the States, I would see her once every 2 years. So I talk to her all the time, once a week, twice a week. Totally different family structures, right? I picked her because she had all the pieces of the picked her. That sounds awful. I saw her in a lineup and I picked her. No, you know, she was perfect for me because she had all the voids in my life that I wanted to have filled. So, is that kind of like what you went after with your wife? Like, what really attracted you to her is that she filled in all these different voids that you thought, man, I really want that.
Well, I will tell you that my mom to this day teases me because I would never talk to her about dating when I was, you know, in the dating scene as a young man in his 20s. And I was clearly starting to see my wife on a very regular basis. And I just described her to my wife very simply this way. She can cook, she has a job, and she has a college degree. And those were like, those three things were really important.
Yeah.
Especially the cooking was really important to me as well, because I was always hungry back then. Yeah, look, my wife is, you know, a strong-rooted, stable person, and yeah. I think that a lot of that does come from her family background. She's got, you know, a good, solid family, and, you know, it's had its challenges, like many sure. of them have. I think she was raised really well. A lot of my parenting is just more intuition. And, you know, you said earlier, and you were dead right, by the way, that I was having to be an adult in the room at a very young age. And so I just sort of understood things. I use intuition a great deal, and I don't read parenting books. I obsess over it. Yeah. And while I think there's things that you can learn from it,
sure.
It's just not something that I would do. I really boil it down to very fundamental right and wrong. And what kind of a person do I want my kid to be?
Yeah.
And I try to guide them based on that. And I don't necessarily think it requires some all world, you know, Cleaver family parenting model for that.
Yeah.
I'm sure that I've made my share of parenting mistakes. I'm sure that I'll make more.
Yeah.
But I think that anyone that knows me, knows my family, knows my kids, will tell you that I'm a pretty darn good dad.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean to like shit on someone who reads parenting books, by the way, but I've seen so many people read them and then abide by them, and it ends up ruling their world to make choices. And I'm thinking, you're really overcomplicating this. There's no need. So
yeah, it can be really simple.
Yeah. So, all right. Yeah. So what I want to do is do my fast five. These are five random questions. Answer them as fast or slow as you like. And then I want to talk about kind of just the industry you're in, right? Because it's kind of a fascinating industry in some ways, because the fact of just the economic environment and how a vote on November 7th made the stock market, you know, go crazy because they see a businessman coming in the office and so forth. So, and we can skate over politics, you know, if that's something you're comfortable with, especially in your position, but you know, all right. So you ready to do fast five?
Let's do it.
All right. Question one, you've already kind of answered. What was your first job ever?
Well, my actual first legitimate job for a third party, I'd answer that two ways. First was really working in my parents' plumbing company, digging ditches, you know, going back and forth from a truck into a house to help fix a toilet, whatever needed to be done there. My first employer job, where I was an employee of someone's, was I was a grocery sack boy at a grocery store when I was 14 years old.
Did you learn anything about that? Besides, I didn't want to do that job for the rest of my life, which is always the common answer. But did you learn something from that job?
Sure. Well, I learned a couple of things. I learned that I didn't want to work outside in the heat, because really you're going in and out all day. And in the summers in Texas, like I said, it's really hot. I'll tell you what I really started to discover about myself then. And I tell my kids this story all the time. If there's one thing I would say about me, and that I like about me, is that I'm a really resourceful guy. And now that's, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? So I sort of at an early age became really resourceful. Well, so true story, when I would sack people's groceries in the summer, I was always thirsty and dehydrated from going in and out all day, and I didn't get a lot of breaks at this job. So people buy a lot of grapes in the summer, and I would always place, when I take people's groceries out to the car, I'd put the grapes really close to the back of the cart, and I would eat their grapes that they just purchased in the grocery store while looking out to their car. And so I never got hungry and always stayed hydrated because I was eating people's grapes.
That's awesome.
So yeah, there's my lesson from sacking groceries.
All right, question two. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
That guy has to relax. He really does. that's what I would say, is I would just tell me to relax. And by the way, a lot of people did when I was 25. And I'll tell you, it's a double-edged sword. I wish that I were a little less intense And I wish that I had been brighter about politics in the work environment, because I just couldn't stand political environments, because I always felt that if I worked harder and was one of the, you know, guys in the room that could solve problems, then I deserved always to move up and be recognized. Mm-hmm. And it took me years to figure out that politics and relationships were unbelievably important. And I did finally figure that out. Those are the two things I needed to know at 25. But I will tell you this, the intensity I had in 25 was really key to getting anywhere I'm at as well.
I didn't ask this earlier, but what do you think that intensity was derived from? I mean, was it a fear of going backwards? Was it a fear of failure? Was it a fear of, or what was that? Do you have any idea what the underlying drive was?
Well, sure. I think a lot of that was still sort of held over for, you know, just having sort of a challenging environment to, you know, I always felt like I was having to work a lot harder to get in the same room as other people.
Like to prove yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. I always felt I needed to prove myself. I always felt I was sort of a leg down, harder to get in the room. What I never really appreciated at the time is I was probably 10 years younger than a lot of the people in that room. I was never one that really celebrated the sort of positives that I had been created. I was always focused on where I wasn't. And I was intense. And, you know, it was really important for me to kind of understand that. Look, I think it was just driven from the environment that I grew up in. And I was unwilling to live my life a certain way. I was definitely fearful of failure. And fortunately, one day sort of realized that I was good enough and that I did deserve to be where I was. And I started relaxing a little bit.
How old were you, think, when that started to happen?
No, I was definitely in my 30s.
It's definitely something I struggle with even now. Like, you know, I mean, I have more degrees than probably most people will ever have. I have two masters and a PhD. Like, it's obscene how many I have. Like, there's no need for it, period. Like, I know it. Mm-hmm. But I always felt like I had to keep trying to prove myself. Like, how smart am I? Look at guys, I'm not stupid. Like, don't treat me like I'm dumb. And like, and so it's been an ongoing life struggle for me. And I feel like I've probably gotten in my own way more times than not. Because if you were to work with me, I'm the guy in the office that everyone kind of likes, because I'm just the jovial, happy guy no matter what. And then it could be the worst day and I'm going to make a joke about it and just kind of keep going on, because that's life.
I agree.
Yeah. I don't know. I find this
So I'll tell you that there was a key moment for me. And actually, I credit my wife with this, and she might have created a monster at the time. But I was having some challenges at, we lived in Atlanta. I was working for a large wealth management company. I got into my car to go to work today, and I think she had already left the house or something. And there was a little book and a card with a bow on it. And the book was, I forget which one, because I have so many of them now. It was a Dr. Seuss book. And the theme of the Dr. Seuss book was basically, you're good enough. And I've always loved Dr. Seuss, and I think there are unbelievably powerful life lessons for children and adults in Dr. Seuss books. And this is what sort of turned me on to my love for Dr. Seuss. But she wrote this note in there that said, hey, you're good enough. Don't get frustrated. Stay focused on what you do well. And I sat there in my car and I read the book, and it just really helped me. It's just sort of start centering myself on relaxing, because I could achieve so much more if I just did move out of that. I've got to figure out how to survive mode and start kind of trying to master the next level of skills. And then the other thing I did is I've invested heavily in my career in executive coaches, because I want to be challenged. I want someone to tell me where and how I can be better.
Question three, what animal best represents your management style? My favorite question.
That's a good one. You know, I don't think it's a glorious animal by any means. You know, I would, if I had to compare myself to an animal, I would probably say something as simple as a raccoon. You know, they're resourceful beasts. They're social. You never had a raccoon?
Never had a raccoon yet.
I try to be humble. look, they're extremely resourceful animals. They can live in a city. They can live in the mountains. They can live in the country. a raccoon can find a way to feed itself when it needs to be fed. They're pretty social animals. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they know how to take care of themselves and their offspring.
I think that's a great answer.
Or what I relate to is the resourcefulness, because my resourcefulness, which I think was born in my sort of upbringing and the necessity to take care of myself at an early age, has benefited me my entire life.
Question four, this is my morbid question of the lot. What, when you die, when you were pushing up roses or daisies or whatever you want planted at your gravestone, what do you want people to say about you at your funeral?
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. I would want my kids to say that, you know, they were loved and that I helped make them a better person. I would hope my wife would say, you know, that I was a great husband and, did well by her, and that she felt loved. And, I would hope that the people that I have spent loads of time with in my career, would have felt that I, you know, made a difference in the industry that I'm in, and helped some people in their lives, to get to the next level, to be a better person, to challenge themselves, whatever it may be.
So great. So last question, if you had the ability and skill, what pro sport would you play?
I would be a professional golfer. There's no doubt about it. It's not a long career. You can make a lot of money. You get to play some of the greatest golf courses in the world. I would definitely be a professional golfer if I could do that.
All right. So that's Fast Five. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. What I want to do with the remainder of the time, we have about 8 minutes, give or take, is I really want to talk about just the industry you're in. So I know a little bit about it. But for my audience sake, you know, you started off by kind of describing that you help financial advisors. Tell me, I'm probably going to say this wrong. You help financial advisors give advice, or you give advice to financial advisors.
Not exactly right. So let me tell you what it is.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Look, if you don't do what I do, there's no reason you should know what I do. We're one of those companies, okay? Yeah. We're the intel inside. Is a great way of looking at what we do. So there are different types of financial advisors. There are advisors at the large banks, wirehouses, and then there are independent financial advisors, okay, which are really focused on the well-being of the client. They're typically working on the same side of the client. They aren't having products or things like that pushed by a large parent company. I serve entrepreneurs who run their own financial services company. And what I do is our company empowers their success. We provide them with a middle and back office, so service operations, technology, investment platforms, due diligence on investments, compliance support, everything they need to go out into their communities and build their own business. So think about it as just the intel inside that helped them build great entrepreneurial endeavors.
So these are somebody that has a, not a CPA, but the other one, the
DFP.
Okay, DFP. I was thinking of like an F something something. Anyhow.
CFP, predominantly CFP, certified financial planners. We serve a ton of certified financial planners.
And so these are people that go get their license, they're Series 6, they're Series 7s, or whatever. And then they go out and they want to start their own business. They don't want to work for a major firm. They want to do their own thing.
That's it.
But they need help on the back end, how to manage the process, how to invest the money, things like that.
Yes, that's it.
So
we provide them with all those tools and resources.
So then who who's your guys' competition? Is it a company like NFP?
No, so, you know, we spun out of NFP, right? Talk about that? We talked about that. So our company is now Kestra Financial. We spun out of NFP in June of last year. So they're actually a client of ours. So we serve their advisors. So anyone that serves the investing public is our competition, but in our very unique sort of sleeve, there's the largest company is called LPL. There's a Raymond James, in terms of just kind of like the larger household names. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of really good quality organizations in our space.
And so what is your guys' competitive advantage?
You know, our competitive advantage, a couple of things. I think our culture is extremely unique and brings a lot of value that can help people create sort of really strong organic growth. And then technology is definitely a competitive advantage, and scale is a competitive advantage. And the one other thing I think that really makes us unique is that we have a succession program where there's a real demographic sort of challenge in our space, because a lot of independent advisors are in their 60s. And so we have a program where we will actually acquire those businesses from the people we serve.
And then what do you do with that business then? So, like, are there annuities paid back out to them when they retire?
No, we'll buy it. You know, they will typically have some sort of an earn out over 3 years. But, you know, we typically pay them a multiple on earnings, just like any other acquisition. And then they'll usually stay around for 3, maybe 5 years, maybe more, depending on their age. And we will work to sort of institutionalize the business a little bit more and bring in the next generation of leadership as employees, not entrepreneurs, and they'll run and grow the business.
So I'm going to ask you kind of probably a tough question, and you can punt on this if you want, but this is just my curiosity.
Okay.
Do you think the financial industry has gotten too complex?
I think it's extremely complex, and I think a lot of the complexity comes from regulators, to be honest with you. And the regulators in our space are all well-meaning, and they have the consumer in mind, and that's certainly what they should do. There's not always a strong partnership with the actual businesses, though, to figure out the best way to sort of do it. Look, our country has gone through pretty serious financial crises, market downturns, and so on in the last 20 years while I've been doing this. There is, for a lot of good reasons, a distrust of people in our space. But I will tell you that, seeing the independent world where I serve, these people go out every day and work to make a difference in people's lives. And it's powerful. I mean, it's extremely powerful. And what I would love to see is a far better union between regulators and industry to ultimately serve investors in the best possible way. And I think that adds to the complexity.
So it would seem to me that the divide between what you said and what occurs sometimes is that the larger firms, the JP Morgans and so forth, they have so much power that's where the corruption, if corruption's the right word, but maybe it is, occurs. And I guess the question I have, though, is, so yeah, regulations, everyone complains about regulations. So what happens, like, the regulations always come because something negative occurred, typically, right?
So, true. So yeah, and it's a whipsaw, and it always sort of goes too far.
So how do you, that's my point then, how do you target the bad doer and not punish the whole industry?
Right.
Is jail time, the option? Like, listen, we're serious, so you're going to jail. Because it feels like white collar crime is not penalized typically the same. You know, and this isn't
I've certainly, in my career, seen some episodes where I thought there's these people spend some time in prison. And I think that, you know, your answer is a hard one, because regulators, sometimes, in trying to do the right thing, and that's a really important comment for me to share, they always have the right intention, or I should say often have the right intention. But sometimes the challenge is, when you're trying to overcorrect for investors being treated poorly, you can throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. And I think that is unfortunately what happens. I think there needs to be just really strong enforcement of wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is on the shoulders of those of us in the industry. And a lot of that is getting the right sort of alignment with regulators.
So just kind of based on what you said, is the alignment, but also just the social pressure of the industry saying that you need to act accordingly, you need to act in good faith, you need to have fiduciary responsibility for your clients and our industry on the whole.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I, we... strong advocates of a fiduciary standard in our business, very strong advocate for that. And people need to do the right thing for their clients. And we as an industry, with the help of regulators, need to get rid of bad people.
So I guess a couple of questions left, and then I'm going to let you run. I was curious, like, because now the stock market is through the frickin' roof at this point, right?
Done well.
It's done really well. But is there a concern that it's totally overvalued at this point? Or is that something you can't really comment on? I don't want to get you in trouble. I don't know the legalities of you commenting on the financial markets.
No, look, I've learned to not get over my skis on these things. Here's what I would say is, you know, the stock market, keep in mind, is really the aggregate of a bunch of the value, the perceived value of a bunch of different companies. And I think it's anytime you see a large run up like we've seen, you know, since the election, there's reasons for it. And, you know, will there be a correction of some sort, small, large, whatever? It's likely, but it's and healthy for the markets to correct. But I will tell you that we've spent a lot of years having a pent up valuation when the economy has actually performed far better. The problem with the economy is that it's not reality as much as perception.
Yeah.
So when different parties, you know, when people are running for office and especially the presidency as we just experienced, you'll have one party talking about how great the economy is and the other one that talking about how horrible it is. Well, what's the truth, right? Because the truth doesn't show up when politicians are talking.
Sure.
And you know, what's the reality? Well, the reality is that the economy has performed quite well over the last several years. Our rebound out of the financial crisis 10 years ago was unparalleled by any other nation in the world.
That's what I was going to say.
We rebounded.
And even now, like, look around Europe.
Yeah.
You know, like a 1%
totally
to 2%
right.
growth is like phenomenal for them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So our rebound has been nothing less than amazing. And the economy has performed really well. Now, I do believe as well that, you know, our country needs to find better ways for more people to participate in that lift. I think you can make a lot of sort of political or social arguments around those things. But I would not argue the market is overvalued at the moment. A lot of it could be sort of pent up. And keep in mind that the market, as measured by the Dow or the S&P, is a bellwether for what it thinks is going to happen down the line. You know, people buying stocks and bonds, particularly stocks, are buying them at their current price because they think they will be worth more down the line. So it's a barometer for what may happen in the future. And the reason it's going up is because there is a perspective that our new president will dramatically reduce regulation, will dramatically reduce taxes, which will all put more money back into the economy, which will filter through in a lot of different ways and potentially create opportunity. That's why the market's up.
Well, this is fascinating. My final question, because I could talk to you for an hour, but you have a company to run and I need to get to sleep at some point. You know, for you, where you're at personally, how do you define happiness?
That's a great question. I will tell you that what is most important to me, what I enjoy the most is, and what makes me the happiest, is being with my family. Mm-hmm. It is when I can put every other distraction and priority to the side and just spend time with my wife and my boys. And, you know, we're going to Big Ben next week. It's spring break. So, you know, we're going to go spend 3 or 4 days, excuse me, at a national park. And I'm totally excited about it because you learn so much more about them. It's really sort of focused time. We're going to do a lot of fun things. And that's ultimately what brings me my greatest happiness is experiences and time with my family.
That's awesome. Listen, thank you so much for your time, your energy, and your willingness to sit down with me on this hour-long diatribe. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful
day. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you.